Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
As you look at, well, why did it just keep having seismic overhauls, is because it's a seasonal show. And you give anyone 6 months to think about something before the next step, and they're going to want to change everything. Mm. And look, it did. I do believe it became progressively better and that each iteration improved. But it was basically, we would always laugh, so we called it Camp Christmas, which would always start around January, February, which was, okay, what do we have? Let's throw all the options on the table. And, you know, who's going to stick around? Who's going to be replaced? Who is going to actually be in the cast? The kids grow up every year.
And,
you know, it was always just a different production. And for me, it was like doing four different new musicals.
Yeah.
And it was just a great way to learn. And it gave Ben, Justin, and myself our Broadway debut, our first cast album, so much. And it was a remarkable experience.
Welcome, everybody, to a musical theater podcast where we discuss the cultural and emotional impact of some of our favorite musicals in theater history. My name is Jeffrey Scott Parsons. You can call me Jeff. I have a bunch of sisters in my family, and the only thing that brings them as much joy as watching Hallmark during Christmas is watching Hallmark during Christmas in July. And you know what? It's been a tough month. There's been a lot of stuff that's gone down, so we are celebrating Christmas in July, and gosh dang it, it's gonna be awesome. Today, we're talking about A Christmas Story with the man who will no doubt have to answer how on earth you get children to sing beautiful harmonies. It's the original musical director of A Christmas Story. Everyone, welcome, Ian Eisendrath. Yay!
Thank you. It's great to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Welcome. Welcome. I'm so grateful that you're here. Now, let's talk first. You are maybe best known for musically directing a show that, like Christmas in July, can act as a balm to the soul. Maybe it's the current king of said genre, Come From Away.
Yes, yes.
Gorgeous show.
Thank you so much.
You were nominated for a Grammy for it, which I got. Okay, so we did our episode on Come From Away with Gene O'Carr.
Oh, wonderful.
Sweetest guy. And yes. I said in the episode that I love that album because you can just put it on and it's the next best thing to sing it live. You know?
Totally our goal. I'm so glad that you said that. We were, you know, you always, when you put together an album, you start with trying to figure out like, okay, do you want to do this as a bunch of songs that are sort of standalone experiences? Come From Away, to me, has always just felt like
it's so seamless.
One big musical movement, you know, made up all these 100%. Little parts. We just decided, let's just try to essentially recreate an audio version of the show.
The entire thing. That's wonderful. Well, successful. And then you guys filmed it for Apple TV Plus, which is incredible. And congrats on that. How was that? Like, what was different for you in going from the theater to, say, a streaming service?
I mean, you know, it's like the goal was, okay, let's try to make this feel as if in this really challenging pandemic moment where people cannot come together, where we obviously cannot bring people into a theater, let's bring this story, this experience that we all felt would really, really speak to the moment, because it is sort of like waking up on 9/12, having just had this awful, unthinkable tragedy and not knowing what comes next and how to cope. And the other thing was that idea of the importance of community and giving people a sense of what that looks like in a time that we couldn't be together and we couldn't come together.
Oh my gosh.
Come From Away couldn't happen.
Full body chills. Yes.
Yeah. So I really, so in trying to create the living room theatrical experience, a full proscenium shot of the show would just not read and be emotionally compelling. So it was really fun to work with the director to figure out how he wants to shoot everything. Mm-hmm. And then in terms of the audio capture, it's really interesting because a theater mix is designed to have everything play together and coexist in an environment where sounds can overlap. Yeah. And the key to film mix is you want isolation so that we can really craft the experience for the audience and bring the things that are most in focus to the front, other things to the back.
Right, because whatever the lens is on is what our ear needs to be on.
Yeah, so we had to come up with really creative ways to essentially get clean ensemble vocals, get clean band, all while shooting either isolated shots, which was much easier to do that for, or doing a full run through the show for an audience that was brought together. So it was really interesting because it was really where like theater meets film, and how do we retain the theatrical experience while making this something that you are experiencing on screen.
Right.
A small screen.
Not to put a perfect bow on this, but speaking of theater and film coming together in a musical way on Apple TV with Christmas elements.
Yeah.
I mean, can you talk a little bit about what's happening at the end of the year?
Yes. I just called you to say I'm running 10 minutes late because we're in the middle of a final mix for Spirited, which is a brand new, it's almost like a musical fantasy with a score by Pasek and Paul, starring Will Ferrell, Ryan Reynolds, Octavia Spencer. I started working on it in December of 2020.
Wow.
And was full-time every day, January of 2020 until now. Now finally at the time that we are doing the final mix. We're bringing all the elements together. We're in a theater and we are seeing the film on the big screen and figuring out where music is going to sit in the mix, where every element of vocals and instrumental and taps for the tap dancing, sound effects, all of that lives. And it's very exciting. This film is really special. In a lot of ways, it's a love letter and having fun with the musical as a genre. It's a very self-aware that we're breaking into song and every number is sort of an over extra explosive experience. But at the same time, it's a comedy and also a super moving story. And it's not, I wouldn't describe it as serious, but I would describe it as utterly heartwarming and heartbreaking. And it's very ambitious. We're trying to do a lot. And I'm excited for people to experience it.
Yes, I can't wait. That sounds like a joy. Is it so Apple TV Plus, obviously, but is it also going to be on the big screen, do you think?
Well, I'm optimistic it will be. I think that will sort of depend on what the next several months look like in so many different ways.
In many different ways. Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Sure. Okay, so now A Christmas Story. I thought this was going to be such a simple project, like a simple episode, but then I sat down and started thinking about all of the elements of the history that goes behind this, and there is so much history to A Christmas Story. So we have to start with the movie, right? 1983
is
when the movie comes out. It's based on kind of the monologues and writings of Gene Shepherd, who is a very popular radio personality, kind of like Garrison Keillor, right?
Yes, absolutely.
From Prairie Home Companion. So it's I don't want to say tongue-in-cheek, but there is kind of a self-aware look at the banality of maybe Midwestern life that's really being...
100%. It was having, and I think self-aware with a bit of, like, nostalgic humor.
Nostalgia,
right?
100%. Where the love comes from.
It's 100% nostalgia, yes.
Yeah.
But also, I have to think at the time when the film came out, it was a little edgy too, you know, just to do something. Sorry.
Especially in terms of a holiday film, because this is what I was going to say. We didn't watch this one in my house. The kid drops the F-bomb, like the bad one.
Absolutely.
We didn't really watch this Christmas movie.
That's funny. Yeah.
But it was unavoidable because you got 24 hours of A Christmas Story every year on TBS since the mid-90s, you know?
Yeah.
So what about you, though? Did you watch it?
It was one that came up every year growing up. And I don't know if you have those things that it's sort of like, this looks old. I don't really get this. It was almost a little uncomfortable in some ways just because it was sort of this gritty look. And I didn't quite get it because I didn't grow up in the Midwest. The 40s were certainly not, you know, it's interesting.
Pretty, it's, sort it's of not like pretty.
This, it was this 80s unpretty filter of what the 40s were like.
Of the Depression. did you know that it was the 40s? Because I always just thought, oh, this is what the 80s looked like.
You know, I'm glad you said that because I didn't. Honestly didn't know it was the 40s until I started working on the musical and paid attention to it. And it was one of those things that it'd be on TV and I just sort of clicked past as a kid.
Interesting.
So I really didn't know it well. I didn't have this sense of like, oh my gosh, I love that. In fact, I'm like, oh, that's that weird movie. But then I watched it.
That makes me feel kind of weird inside with like the mean Santa Claus that pushes the kid down.
Exactly.
The...
Yeah. But then I watched it as an adult and I was like quite charmed by it.
We have the exact same experience here.
And I started reading Gene Shepherd. And
did you really?
And I really loved the source material that it came from, listening to him. And my wife actually introduced me to Garrison Keillor, who I also didn't know growing up. And I'd sort of fallen in love with his Prairie Home Companion, especially the like Wobegon stuff.
Oh my gosh.
And I'm like oh, wow, this is like that. And the musical could be like that.
Mm-hmm.
So then I was asked to do it. This would have been, I'm trying to remember the year, 2010. And I was probably approached in July, August of that year. And the first production was going to be happening in Kansas City, Missouri. I think it was, we started rehearsal in October.
Oh, wow.
And it was one of those things where I was just sort of brought into the project and it was like, here, go. And it was interesting because the score was very intelligent, but very Sondheim, very sophisticated with dissonance and a little bit of atonality. And I was surprised by that. I was like, okay, this is an interesting challenge. And I remember how challenging it was to rehearse and get this music together. And then also just coming into this world with a new director and choreographer and team I hadn't worked with before. And they really had a clear vision for what the piece would be. And I don't know that the score necessarily supported that. But then we also had Larry Blank, who's legend.
And of course.
He was the person that had recommended me and got me involved. And he and I were definitely, you know, partners in figuring this out in Kansas City. And then his work, you know, he wrote these gorgeous charts that really captured the era. And I was
orchestrator and arranger, Larry Blank.
Yes, yes. And, you know, his work is across so many shows. One of them is White Christmas, which had come out, I think, about 2 years before that, the stage musical.
Irving Berlin's White Christmas.
Exactly, Irving Berlin's, yes. And he gave it a little bit of this nostalgic classic sound, and it was like, oh, this is what the show wants to be. And then what was interesting is we opened in Kansas City, and audiences ate it up. It was like...
Really?
It was like, this is this, it felt, I'd done the Rocky Horror Show and it felt like that. It felt like the audiences were there because they love the movie. They knew the movie and they wanted all these bits and all these moments. And yet anyone who knows what a musical can do and should do, like the bones of this, the structure of this is so good, but it's not adding up. And the songs are certainly not landing. And the audience is not engaging emotionally in the music. And it doesn't feel like music that sort of emanates from the stars of the show's mouths who were kids.
Interesting.
You know, it felt very sophisticated for kids. Composer, so talented. You know, it's nothing to do with that person's ability. It was just, it wasn't a match. I had a full-time job as the music supervisor and director of new work at the Fifth Avenue Theater in Seattle. And I called David Armstrong, who was our artistic director. And I was like, you should just come see this because I'd be really, really curious, you know, because Fifth Avenue and new musicals is what they were doing. And sort of being the final sort of smoothing process and the sort of
launching
tryout point. Launch point, yes, for many, many Broadway musicals. And David and Bernadine Griffin, who was our managing director, came and they, you know, were very perceptive. And David was like, look, this could be a hit. The bones of the show works. It just needs to be filled in with a brand new score. And tough Jerry call. Gehring, yeah, and Jerry Gehring was our producer and the director. You know, everyone's sort of aligned on that, and it was tough because it's also very unique to be like, we're actually going to move forward with the show. We're going to keep everything but the score.
Yeah.
But we love these moments and everything's working, so we need to find a team to recreate the score. And at that moment, they reached out to various agents and wanted to find, you know, the next generation Aarons and Flaherty that can sort of write character, write period, but give it a contemporary, very listenable and appealing vibe. And five or six different teams submitted, all very talented. It's funny because I look at the list and almost every single one of them that submitted demos now have major careers and are, you know, they absolutely are.
Oh my gosh, I would love to see that list.
Next voices.
Yeah.
Totally. However, it was very clear the second that Benj and Justin's material came in that that was the match. It fit like a glove. They were hired. And they basically had 6 months to write a full brand new score that would start getting orchestrated, rehearsed, and in previews on the Fifth Avenue's 2,200 seat stage. And it was like a mad dash to the finish line. And basically, we were trying to recreate the iconic moments, but with brand new lyrical musical content. And it was really interesting, you know, and they are tremendous. And it was, we met and we really just hit it off. The funny thing is that we didn't know each other, even though the year that I'd graduated the University of Michigan, that spring, they started that fall. And
oh
we all
gosh.
Have the same teachers, the same classes, same background, so it was very easy to work together. We're all story-driven musical artists that, you know, are always going to be wanting the highest of musical quality, but character, text, and storytelling is of ultimate value and importance. And it was just a really great match. And we had just a wonderful wild time of staying up most nights till 3 or 4 a.m. throughout the rehearsal period and previews, working on all the rewrites and getting everything ready for the production. And it was
it
was wild. And then the other funny thing, which I now look back on, it's like, that was so crazy, is the day after we froze for the very first out-of-town production, we recorded the cast album.
Okay, so this is where, because as I was doing my research, reading the script, listening to the different recordings, whether it was the live version or this premiere recording, lots of changes.
Oh my gosh. I mean, it's funny to look back on. It's like, it's something I would never do again. And I would highly recommend against it, because of course the show is going to change in a million and one ways before you find its ultimate version. But at that point, to everyone's credit, one didn't know if and how it was going to move on. There's a world that it could have gone into licensing or
right away.
Into
That's
like
so true.
A non-union tour or regional productions. I don't think Broadway was the obvious next step, and it wasn't the next step.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a production the following year that was essentially a national tour that landed in Chicago. And so, again, that's a really non-standard way to do things, because we were rehearsing and prepping a show to go on tour, which we only had like a four-week rehearsal process. But really what we were doing was a version 3.0 of the show, with a different director, with a different choreographer, with brand new dance music, with some new set elements, a brand new cast. And so we did that. And the thing that happened for the show that, you know, we'll all be forever thankful for is it landed in Chicago and received amazing reviews. And that is what I think paved the way for Jerry Gehring, our commercial producer and team, to bring us to Broadway the following year.
Hey, listeners, I know in the past I've discussed my relationship with Taco Bell. I get done yelling at children at rehearsal, I get my app out, order, drive there, pick up the food, drive home. It still takes over 30 minutes. Well, Factor is a company that's going to solve all of those issues, except the children doing theater part. Every fresh, never frozen meal is chef crafted, dietitian approved, take that Taco Bell, and ready to go in just 2 minutes. You have over 35 options every week to choose from, including protein plus and keto options. Here's the thing, though. Factor delivers everywhere in the United States except for Hawaii and Alaska, which means I can't try it and I need you to do it for me. It's less expensive than takeout, and every meal is nutritious and delicious. Head to factormeals.com/musicaltheater50, that's musical theater with an E-R, and use code musicaltheater50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code musicaltheater50 at factormeals.com/musicaltheater50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. Get that deal, get that food, and let me know how it is.
The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
And you open on Broadway in 2012, right?
Yes.
In time for Christmas for a limited engagement at the L'Enfantin.
Yeah.
It's a great time. And then Tony Award nominations come out.
Well, and
the next
that, okay,
year.
That's a great story because I'm, you know, Christmas Story's closed. It was seasonal.
Yeah, it was like, just
that
a thing.
That was awesome. Yeah. Uh-huh. And I remember, I wasn't even paying attention to when Tony nominations came out, like not even on my radar. And I remember my wife comes running in my bedroom in the morning, our bedroom, and was like, Ian, Christmas Story was nominated for a Tony. And I was like, shut up. Like, don't, you know, I thought it was like a joke. She's like, no, no, look. And we were all just stunned. And, you know, granted,
and not just one, by the way. It's not just like the random design nomination.
No, it's best musical. It was score
and book.
Orchestrations, I think. Yeah, orchestrations and book. And it was, yeah, it was just delightful. And then it was like, once again, that brought us all back together to create a Tony number. Really challenging when you're not a running show. You know, everyone had left and just moved on with their lives and their careers. And so it was a challenge to get everyone back together. But it was thrilling.
And I will forever be grateful because it meant that we got to see Caroline O'Connor on the Tony Awards.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, that was really, really fun to see her come back, and because I think she'd returned to Australia at that point, so you know, flew her back, and that number is so amazing. And that number was the brainchild of John Rando and Warren Carlyle, because John was like, well, what if we sort of do like a Bugsy Malone thing? And Warren's like, I've got it. And then Glenn Kelly, the very famous dance arranger, worked with Warren and created this amazing dance arrangement, and Bench and Justin obviously wrote an adorable fun fantasy song.
Oh, how exciting. And the show has only since, I will say this, I love when shows don't need to be a huge Broadway hit, a huge Wicked 10-year type run in order to then have, forgive the term, I've already used it, launching point into their cultural impact, because the show has continued to be performed all over the country. And I think that it's because it could have, you know, a limited run on Broadway, get some Tony nominations, get some acclaim, and also give talented people like yourself an amazing platform to then go into the rest of their careers.
Yeah, no, it's something I'll be forever grateful for and cherish all those memories.
So we're going to start at the top of the show and just talk through some of these beats, because the show, like the movie, acts as a memory piece, right?
Yeah.
It's about this narrator looking back on Christmas memories. And one of the things that I've really respected about the movie, returning to it as an adult, is how much, and maybe this is where the discomfort came from when I was watching it when I was little, is how much of it is about accountability, about this adult person looking back on their mistakes. Because Ralphie messes up a lot during, you know, this story. He lies about his best friend. He beats somebody up, you know, pretty badly. He swears, you know, these sorts of things aren't necessarily things that we would see a child protagonist do. And yet, because the narrator is taking responsibility for them in both a humorous way and a loving way as well, you know, to almost like he's given himself a little bit of grace by being able to laugh at all of the mistakes that we make as children. And they're so I find that really beautiful.
Yeah. And I think I have such a, I love what you're saying. It's an interesting way of looking at it. Cause I actually hadn't looked at it that way before. And I've always thought of it, and I think these two ideas work hand in hand a little bit as a reconciliation of his relationship with his father and sort of understanding that as an adult and looking back on all the things that he did as a kid to win that love, to know that he was all right, almost looking at like the roller coaster ride he went on, all the crazy hurdles he went through just to know he was loved. I mean, it's like an adult therapy session. But also to see sort of the fearless desperation of what it means to be a kid. And so I think that's what you're saying is to own that, like, you know what? These were crazy, half-witted ideas. But first of all, they're very funny to look back on, look at what I did. And then look at why. And I think what is so beautiful and funny about the Gene Shepherd is that you have this kid playing out all these actions with the inner monologue of an adult who now understands what the was actually going on and how the wheels were turning. But then it ends, and I'm sure you were wanting to wait to get to this. I won't talk a lot about it, but just, you know, at the ending, he unpacks it as it was really just all about one simple thing. Mm-hmm. Had nothing to do with a gun. All it was is I just wanted to know that my dad loved me and that he was listening.
Yeah. Yeah. There's things to learn here as both grown up children and grown up adults. You know what I
mean? Yeah. Who are all at the end of the day, at least a part of us is a child.
Is a child.
And, exactly. And I think that's also what's so charming about it is we all are that dichotomy that we see on the Christmas Story stage, which is the adult with the more sophisticated point of view and the kid who's just trying to know that he's loved.
We're talking about this story and the movie and how it can often be sardonic and morose, and you turn it into a splashy musical and it's going to end up getting slicker. Like there's no way that it can't be. But I also actually am really down. I can speak as a fan of this idea of turning it into a musical because nostalgia is never realism.
Exactly.
And in fact, the way, especially in the movie, the way that the writing and the things are played out is quite operatic because we're seeing it from a child's eyes. There's nothing greater. There's nothing more important than this one Christmas present, which is ridiculous. So when emotions are that strong, hello, musical number. It's a great opportunity to translate and into the art form.
And this was a kid who lived in the world of fantasy. So, you know, so much of this is in his head and how he is perceiving himself or how he's perceiving what he wants to be, that it was just so easy to make a fast 180 into a Western number, you know, where he's this cowboy, to this nightclub where, you know, he's going in a tux and with, you know, little gangster with, you know, gangster's balls and they're all being threatened and afraid for their lives, to a gigantic Broadway Bugsby Berkeley type number. Like, yeah, the material, and even the film does go into fantasy as well. So it's very just much like, okay, it's fantasy. it's a big musical number. And those aren't the only ways that music was employed, but it was so the invitation to blow up into gigantic musical numbers.
That's the invitation. Great way of saying it. So we're talking, of course, about the Parker family. In the Parker family, you got Ralphie, who's our main guy, may or may not, he is, the younger version of this narrator, Gene Shepherd. And yeah. In the musical, there is a character named Gene who actually is the narrator. In the film, we usually only get to hear him, but
in
here
voiceover,
on stage,
and now right? This is turned into a fully fleshed out character.
Ralphie has a little brother named Randy, who we all remember because once he puts on his snowsuit, he can't put his arms down. They have a hardworking mother who has some really sympathetic material. Look, nobody does a second act mother number quite like Pasek and Paul. And
right? And they know how to do those.
They know how to do those. Dear Evan Hansen has, of course, I think probably the best one. And there's a beautiful one in here as well.
Yeah.
And then we've got the old man, right? This father figure who is so essential to the story. And they're getting ready for Christmas. Ralphie has decided that the gift that he wants more than anything in the world is greens and nothing. No, it's it's an official Red Ryder range model carbine action BB gun with a compass in the stock and this thing that tells time. And if you need any sort of inkling as to what the sense of comedy is with Gene Shepherd's writing, it's right here, right? He feels so passionate about a thing that he can't even really describe. And it has this thing that tells time. Can Ralphie even tell time? We're not sure. But the point is that this rifle has it. This is what he wants more than anything. And the whole musical or the whole story really revolves around him planting this idea into his parents' brain to make sure that he gets it on Christmas. Did you have in your childhood any sort of thing like this? Not necessarily with Christmas, but just in terms of really devising a plan to get your parents to...
I mean, this is going to be a disappointing answer.
It's all good.
It was never
a
thing.
Like I have a good one.
Yeah, it was okay. You should answer. It was never like a thing that I wanted. It was experiences that I wanted.
Oh, okay.
You know?
Yeah.
So I was always like, I want to. Honestly, for me, it was like I want to do these theatrical or musical projects. And the truth is, my parents were very aware and listening and loving, so I got to do them.
That's
and
really
I do that. But still, I mean, there was always that devising of like, oh my gosh, this is going to require my mom to drive me from one theater camp to the other and, like, you know, like all that scheming. And then as I got older, getting the independence and permission to do things.
Yes.
So I think that's more how I approached it. But I want to hear your story.
No, but I'm also picturing little Ian like planning it out in his room. Like, okay, this camp ends at 3 p.m.
Exactly.
We get in the car.
Yeah.
We can 100% make it across to town. Across town. For me, this one experience comes to mind, and I'm from Utah, and in Salt Lake City, there was a national tour coming through of A Chorus Line. I had never seen A Chorus Line. I hadn't even really heard A Chorus Line, but I knew that A Chorus Line was something that I needed to witness as a child. I never did, by the way, because you probably don't take children to A Chorus Line.
Totally.
The point being is that I knew that the national tour was coming through. And I prayed a lot.
Oh, I love it. I love it.
That my grandparents would just randomly call up. And I used the Think system. I used prayer. I sat and looked at our rotary phone and pictured it calling or pictured it ringing. And I just knew that they were going to call and say, you know what? We've found an extra ticket in our season subscription and we're going to bring you along. And I tried to drop all of the hints, and boy, oh boy, did it fall flat.
It's amazing. But that's literally, you had your Ralphie expert. That's exactly, I mean, I think that so much of the show is about this character on this mission, and it's like failed attempt after failed attempt after failed attempt, and then a total give up on Christmas. The worst Christmas of his life.
Yeah. No, like, there's nothing left to live for, truly.
And then the sweetest, sweetest surprise at the end. But I so relate to that. And what's interesting in the process, and I really got to be involved with and live through every iteration, was like, how do we get inside this character's head and establish the validity of this want. Because it's ridiculous, and it's so easy for an audience to judge, you know, just like to write that off and not be invested in it. And, you know, we went through many, many opening numbers, and it's interesting to look at the things that were tried and true and evergreen. It was always important that we established that Christmas is the season of anticipation.
Ooh, and that's so true.
Got to get it right, because you only have one a year. And during the Depression in the Midwest, it's the one moment when you could justify having a want or making your children or loved ones' dreams come true, and that you would just stretch a little bit. So every time we did an opening number that was the least bit successful, you always established sort of the town of home in Indiana, the family, and finally Ralphie, and the idea that this is a highly loaded time of anticipation and you only get one shot. And it's interesting, once Bench and Justin started writing the score, the idea of counting down to Christmas was a number. And it's funny that we went from counting down to Christmas, and I love this. And I remember we were just having a brainstorming session, and I can't remember if it was Ben, Justin, John Rando, but someone was like, it all comes down to Christmas. That's the point. It all comes down. It's not about counting down. That's low stakes. It's the fact that everything in my life comes down to Christmas. And the song sort of found its final form with that.
Yeah, that takes my mind so many places. Especially looking at how maybe Depression era was one gift, right? Whereas now I think most of my nieces and nephews would be incredibly disappointed if they only got one gift for Christmas. And yet it's all based in the same thing, which is like, this is Christmas. We got to get it right. And we're also surrounded by this marketing machine that tells us we need more and more and more.
Right. And it's what's interesting to me is, as a kid, I looked forward to Christmas, but I was not having the Ralphie experience. I think it's just because I was really fulfilled doing the things I was doing. I had, you know, my issues and my pain, but it wasn't needing to get a gift. But it's interesting, as a parent, I have three kids, and I'm so aware that I have really less than 14 shots, you know, probably more like 10 by the time they're old enough and before they become, you know, teens that are a little bit wiser. I have, you know, so 10 shots to make my kids' fantasies come true. And then I also have this son, Charlie, who, it's so funny because I've not thought about this till we just started this podcast, but he's 10 years old, and there's times that we almost like judge him for being like a little bit entitled or materialistic, because he really thinks about, you know, I really, really want this thing, and he becomes consumed with it. But I'm all of a sudden like, oh, that's so sweet. And like, I know that it, you know, it's like he wants this thing because he thinks it's going to complete him. And, you know, it's like, it's just this childish, in a positive way, like childlike, innocent, naive place that one day he's not going to be there. And it's like, it just makes me want to like, just cherish it and not get him every single thing he wants, but really those listening moments where you can make their dreams come true. Those you only have a few, you know, and I think
dang, I learned something about being a parent today. Thank you. No, because I love that. It's not about getting them what they want. It's about making their dreams come true. And I think that if you're right, if you listen, you probably have a better chance of doing it.
Yeah. And you want to, because you know they're facing hard things. They're going to face hard things. And you really want to give them these experiences where they feel seen.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is what it's about. And like, I also, I don't know, like for me, one of the most heartbreaking moments, and I remember it being a kid, but then also seeing it on my kids, is when they receive something and it's not the thing that they want, but then you see them sort of struggle through to not be disappointed. So as to not be greedy, entitled, or rude at the end of the day. And it's funny because I'm just remembering that that's what happened to Ralphie.
Yeah.
You know, he his dad sort of played a trick on him, and he very
that
much
he didn't,
you
that
know,
he didn't get it.
He
for
didn't
Christmas.
Get it, and he had to sort of stiff upper lip it through all of Christmas.
It is a little bit like a Charlie and the Chocolate Factory thing where he passed the test. Mm. When he didn't get it, he didn't, you know,
yeah.
He doesn't throw a fit. And in fact, right. Maybe that was passing the test.
Yeah, no, I totally, I mean, that's what made him the character deserving of taking on the Chocolate Factory. It's funny, too, because I'm realizing as we're talking that I think almost every year, if not every year, I always do a misdirect as a Christmas gift. In fact, this year was borderline mean. My daughter, like, she was so clear about the things she needed and she wanted. And I really set her up to not get it. But then she was thinking, like, Dad does this every year. And then I really delivered a gift that was like, what do you call it? Like a...
Oh, sure. Red herring sort of thing.
Red herring. That's like a red herring. And so I watched her be like, oh, my gosh. I've been so clear all year about this thing that I actually need. And my dad got me this, and it was like an experience. I think it was like a promise. I promised to take her to Harry Potter Odset experience in London. And it was very viable as a thing that she would love, but it was absolutely not what she asked for. Uh-huh. And I literally watched her be like, yeah, you just like really didn't listen to me, and pretend to be like, thank you, Dad. And then I gave her the thing. And, you know, I remember my wife was like, that is so mean. Like got mad at me for doing that.
Like, that's a little too much, babe.
Yeah, I know. But I think I got it from Christmas Story. I think it's just like implanted in me.
It's
like,
planted from all
do?
These years.
I know. I've conducted the show too many times.
For nearly four decades, JMK Security Solutions has provided protection for homes and businesses. I know firsthand. I'm Jeff Beckman, and with my wife, Kim, we started JMK Security Solutions. Our attention to detail, service after the sale, and product knowledge are the foundation of our success. JMK Security has routinely been recognized as the best of Madison for security companies. We expect that trend to continue as the next generation, our son Jeffrey, takes over as president. Let us protect what is valuable to you. JKSecurity.com.
Hey listeners, I know in the past I've discussed my relationship with Taco Bell. I get done yelling at children at rehearsal, I get my app out, order, drive there, pick up the food, drive home. It still takes over 30 minutes. Well, Factor is a company that's going to solve all of those issues, except the children doing theater part. Every fresh, never frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, take that, Taco Bell, and ready to go in just 2 minutes. You have over 35 options every week to choose from, including protein plus and keto options. Here's the thing, though. Factor delivers everywhere in the United States except for Hawaii and Alaska, which means I can't try it and I need you to do it for me. It's less expensive than takeout, and every meal is nutritious and delicious. Head to factormeals.com/musicaltheater50, that's musical theater with an ER, and use code musicaltheater50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code musicaltheater50 at factormeals.com/musicaltheater50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. Get that deal, get that food, and let me know how it is. So in the show, there are obviously so many great iconic moments in these little chapters that come up throughout the show and throughout the story. But some of the musical numbers that I have to point out that I think are just my absolute faves. Ralphie to the Rescue.
Oh, I think that is
perfection.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's
so great.
So it's like Hollywood cowboy fantasy.
Magnificent Seven. It's got that whole sound.
Yeah.
And it's when Ralphie's picturing himself as, you know, the Wild West hero of the
King
world.
King of the Wild West, yeah. Yeah. And oh, I'll never forget the first time we sang Justin's vocal arrangement and rehearsed, "Get him, cowboy, cowboy Ralphie." You know, it was like that sort of swoony period vocal with the
yes,
you know, groove underneath it. And then seeing everyone doing this country western, you know, Hollywood choreography, it was just, that is a number, and that's like those moments where you just know, okay, this is a thing.
Completely agree, love that number. the thing that the adults always keep saying to Ralphie about wanting this gun is that he'll shoot his eye out. And that he's, you know, too young to be trusted with a BB gun, which I'm sure is incredibly triggering for a child.
Right. And it's like very fair, but yeah, it's basically saying
you're not big enough.
I feel like he hears it. It's not only you're not big enough, but you're not worthy.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, I think that it's like, yeah, you can handle that. You haven't proved yourself. We don't trust you. And that's the most deflating thing to hear.
And it really comes with a position of power, too, because there are these bullies at school that are absolute terrors.
His teacher. It's just like, yeah, there's all these people that are not seeing him, that are judging him unworthy, that are diminishing him. And while it's all done through the Gene Shepherd cynical, sardonic humor lens, we all can relate to that.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes. I think Ralphie's father's going through something similar. He's always seeking for some sort of power and feeling empowered in his life. He's putting all of his energy into this crossword puzzle contest because that'll make him feel special amidst the furnace constantly breaking down and the car breaking down and all of these little things that are the dogs next door who are always barking at him.
He has a hard life, right? Like, yeah, there's the world on his shoulders. He is such a sort of classic, like, 40s blue-collar stereotypical. But, like, yes, you're right. He's going through the same thing of, like, feeling like one of the masses and needing to be special. I think that's the beauty of this thing is that, like father, like son, the father's going through a very similar thing, having a similar level of fantasy that I'm going to be the genius.
Yes.
Like, I'm not going to be seen as
genius on Cleveland
just,
Street is the
yes,
song, by the way.
Yeah. Which I love.
So funny. The Peter Pan moment kills me every time.
Oh, it's fine. I'm trying to remember that. We went through many, many different things for what that was. But it's interesting because I just think I knew people like my wife's grandparents even like that were very much sort of working class, world on their shoulders, but knowing that they have this genius within and that, you know, one day, I think it was
everybody will finally see it.
Yes, yeah. I'm going to invent this thing and they would try to invent it and I'm going to all of a sudden be seen for who I am and my future will transform.
And for the old man, he actually does end up winning a major award, as the song is called, from this crossword puzzle contest. And the prize is this hideous leg lamp. It's the infamous leg lamp from A Christmas Story.
Right. Tawdry.
Which, when you think of the time period, right? This, like, stocking leg lamp in the front window of a home. You're like, what on earth is going on inside that house?
Well, it's just, like, it's the sheer hubris and ego and need to be seen as special that, like, you know what? I'm absolutely not going to face the reality that this is a joke and
maybe not a good idea.
Yeah. But I think it's so much about the fact that I need this thing to be a beautiful treasure that I've just won. And so I am just going to fully commit and like just fully go with the fact that this is a piece of art and this is going to transform our lives.
Ergo, the leg lamp is the BB gun.
Yeah, exactly. It's the same thing.
It's the same thing.
Yeah, and once again, just like Ralphie is imagining himself in this Western fantasy, old man is imagining himself in this classic 1940s musical number with a long kick line of beautiful women.
Beautiful beauties.
With these legs. Yeah, it's wild. It's wild.
It gives a new meaning to the term kick line, right?
Yes, yes, yes.
In the second act, we have You'll Shoot Your Eye, which we already talked about, but the teacher who Ralphie thought might be on his side, he wrote this paper about what he wanted for Christmas, and he thought, well, even if my parents don't think I'm speaking from a place of reality, then at least my teacher will catch the vision and be able to tell them. She completely disagrees and gives him a C+. And then we get the great number, "You'll shoot your eye out," which is another fun fantasy sequence for him. The triple dog dare is another of my favorite moments in A Christmas Story. And it's also played out here in the musical where the young boy, what's his name? Is that Schwartz who does that? No, it's Fritz.
A triple dog dare you is Flick. Yes.
Flick. There it is.
Yes.
Flick gets his tongue stuck to the pole. Where did you grow up? Did you grow up in the cold?
No. I grew up in Olympia, Washington. So I was very temperate. Yeah.
Yeah. Gorgeous. I, once again, grew up in Utah. Very cold. I love in this musical how there's the one little monologue for the narrator about, oh, it's when they're putting on the snowsuits and getting ready to go to school.
Oh, yeah.
And because in California, if it dips below, you know, 60 degrees, you're like, ooh, I need my scarf and maybe we should cancel like the whole day.
Right.
but when you live in winter, you just get a snow shovel when it's time to go to work. Like you don't get to not go to work just because there's 3 feet of snow on the ground.
Yeah, you
totally. Life continues. And I love that that is talked about here in a very real way.
No, I agree. And it's funny, I got to know that because I went to school in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Oh gosh.
And I remember being
shocked
by like, wait, I have to walk in this? Like they expect us to go outside? Like there's one day it was so cold that I literally started crying when like the wind like ripped in my face. And I was like, this is just wrong. So I definitely connected to that. But yeah, that moment on the flagpole, I actually just really, really love the lyric, "A sticky situation." And
yes,
I like so much fun. Cause it, you know, the double entendre is fantastic. And that's just a really fun number. And that's one that like, that's not fantasy, but it still lives out in a musical world where all of a sudden you have everyone who's embroiled in this chaotic
controversy.
Crisis.
Yes. Crisis. Yeah. And it kind of shows the
counterpoint and cacophony.
Yes. Yes. And it kind of shows that kids can be dicks, but in like the most innocent way.
Yeah.
Because they've totally abandoned their friend out there and are wanting, figuring out what lie maybe they need to tell so that they don't get in trouble. But like, which is kind of, like I said, a dick move, but they're kids and they're just trying not to get in trouble, which seems to be their only job. Like,
right. Well, and
as children,
because
we just are not supposed to get in trouble.
And it's Christmas. Because if you get in trouble, then you're not going to get your thing.
Oh my gosh. Like, on top of it all, you're so right. You're so right.
I think that was one of the reasons I didn't like the movie growing up. Cause I remember that scene made me so uncomfortable. Because you're just so up close and seeing this kid with
you are up in
there.
That's
stuck
so
to the
true.
Point. And it's like, I never want to see that. And it just looks painful. And my favorite moment in the musical is you're in a scene and everyone is sitting at their desks and out of, you know, far in the back upstage, you're seeing this kid just sort of flailing about on the flagpole and everyone's ignoring it. That brought me continual joy.
That's amazing. Well, all of this chaos has taken a toll on Ralphie and he finally can't take it anymore. And he takes it out on the bully.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a really sobering and kind of beautiful scene because there is no victory in Ralphie beating up this kid. There's no, he did it, and now he's a man, you know? He's crying, the bully's crying, everybody just has all of these feelings that they don't know what to do with.
Well, they've all been, like, reduced to vulnerability.
Yeah.
And I love that. And it starts as a comic scene,
mm-hmm.
you know, with him saying gibberish like his old man does, but then all of a sudden you break into realism and real time beating him up and Ralphie starts crying. The kid starts crying and his mom shows up and a beautiful moment. And it's something I'll always be grateful to my mom for. It's like, I always feel like she took my side and, you know, the mom tells all the kids to go home and sort of gives everyone the proper stern parental response, but then rushes to Ralphie's side and brings him home and then sings my favorite song in the show. Just like that, and like trying to teach him in, you know, 11-year-old appropriate language that when these things in life feel impossible,
remember that the moment will go and that you'll be on the other side of it. Something that I still don't, you know, as an adult, I still don't remember, you know, because, but I think she's really teaching him that important lesson of like, you just got to allow the pain and trust that like you will get through this and get past this. And she partners with Ralphie to not get caught. And I think there's something so beautiful about that. She's sort of a co-conspirator because even she sees that
how hurt he is.
Yeah, and that this is not the moment for old man to give him a dressing down. And oh yeah, I love it. And I just love that song.
I'm not sure there is a more important lesson for us to hear right now, whether it's as children or adults, that our feelings are important and are always temporary.
Yeah, it's so true. Yeah.
It can be both. And it can be both.
Yep, it can both. I agree. The other favorite song of mine is the title song, Christmas Story.
At the end, absolutely.
Like it's just gorgeous. And I think it's just, you know, you go through this whole up and down experience and you end with him receiving this thing after all. And like, you are just, you're so relieved and you're so touched. And then Gene Shepherd as an adult, I think just really sums up, you know, the fact that this was the most memorable Christmas because it was the pain that led to the breakthrough that basically let me know that my dad loved me and that at the end of the day, that's what it was all about, love. And, you know, this text of what a Christmas story to behold, a crazy Christmas story to be told. And it just sort of sums up the idea of nostalgia and that like the highs and the lows, the light and the dark are what create this beautiful memory that, you know, he'll never forget.
I think we all have those memories, the moments when we look back and see how our parents loved us.
Yeah. That you don't understand until you're an adult.
That you don't understand, exactly.
Yeah. It's like until you're in their shoes, whether you're a parent or not, it's just like you suddenly understand, oh, wow, they were dealing with all of this. And this is, yeah, what they did for me.
Yeah. Ah, so fun. See, I feel so good now. My heart is full. Thank you.
I loved revisiting that because I really haven't thought about the musical for, you know, we did the live television experience and that was in 2017. And it's been a minute.
Yeah.
We've been through a lot in the world. And look, I don't know, you know, it's tough right now because you have a show that is centered around a boy wanting a gun.
Yeah.
The last thing we want to put out in the world right now. And I don't know 100%. What will happen with it, but I do think that it's really interesting to explore like what the show's really about.
Good point. Great points, in fact. And even from this is probably even a much longer conversation than we have time for, but looking at the approaches that you needed to shift once you came to the live TV event.
Oh, yeah.
Simply that because of the really cultural changes. And that had only been a few years since you had written it, right? So
they'd written it. Yeah, the world changed those 5 years. But I mean, I've got to say, I don't know, and I could be totally wrong, but it feels like the amount of change we saw in those 5 years doesn't compare to the amount of change that we've seen in the 5 years since.
Mm. Absolutely.
Or has it been 5 years, or am I making up 17, 18, 19? Yeah. Yeah.
No.
And look, it's exactly 10 years ago that Christmas Story this year was on Broadway. So it's like, I what would we do today if we were recreating that musical for today? I don't know that you even could. But for the live television experience, there was responding to the change in the world, also to the incredible actors cast. But then I don't think people realize how much of that change was driven by the fact that we were doing this live across multiple stages and locations on the Warner Brothers lot. So it's like all of a sudden you literally had to plan that Maya Rudolph is going to go get in her golf cart and
they're going to drive her to the next stage, which means the transition music or material needs to be expanded by 1 minute, and we need something there that's going to hold the audience's attention. Like, it's funny,
wow.
Like, the things that were driving all of that. And
literally
the actors were, I mean, I can't believe, when I look back on it, it's like, it's just crazy. They were in real time doing like what we would do in a film shoot across 60 days or more, you know? And it's like, okay, we're going to shoot this on this stage, get in the golf cart, go to this stage. And then we need you to walk down the street, and then we're going to cut to this stage. And the whole thing was so carefully choreographed, and music, of course, becomes completely at the mercy of the timing required,
of the technicality
to pull
of it
this
all.
Off.
Yeah. Wow. Well, congratulations. Regardless of how you feel it went, that's a feat unto itself, just to get it done.
Yeah, no, it sure was. And again, it was a crazy Christmas story. And like, that's the thing that like, every single year of a Christmas story, it's what a Christmas story to behold, a crazy Christmas story to be told. It's just true, you know?
Wow. As always, if you have recommendations for shows you'd like us to cover on A Musical Theater Podcast, you can always email me at amusicalpodcast@gmail.com. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram and Twitter at A Musical Podcast. We've also got Patreon ! Where for only $1 a month, you can receive bonus content. Oh, there's a T Public store that we're now donating all of the money to. Broadway Cares Equity Fights AIDS. Oh my gosh, there are so many wonderful ways to connect with this great podcast community that you all know I am incredibly grateful for. Hey, Ian, how do we follow you? Anything you're up to? Anything you want to plug?
My Instagram is Ian Eisendrath Music. I'm on Facebook. I have a website, ianeisendrath.com. And I really look forward to everyone checking out Spirited and Lyle L. Crocodile, which will be both released this fall, and more to be revealed.
Yes, can't wait. Thank you so much for spending some time with us today. Congratulations on all of your success, and thank you for being a part of our musical theater heritage.
Thank you so much for having me. This was really fun.
Everybody, thank you for listening, and go have yourselves a crazy Christmas story to be told.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but
yeah.
Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.